Welcome back to Airwave, a student-led anesthesia podcast for medical students. My name is Raven, and I'm a third-year medical student at McMaster University. Joining me today is my good friend and co-host, Darissa.
Thanks, Raven, for the warm welcome. My name is Darissa, and I'm also a third-year medical student at McMaster University. As always, this podcast reflects our own views and not necessarily those of our institution. I'd also like to emphasize that the Airwave podcast is not for medical advice, just good old-fashioned medical education.
Today, we'll be talking about anesthetic considerations for atrial fibrillation. We'll start off with an overview of the electrical conduction system of the heart, as well as a focused discussion on the classification of tachyarrhythmias. Then, we'll discuss pathophysiology, complications, and anesthetic considerations for atrial fibrillation. Finally, we'll apply the concepts learned in a clinical case.
Wow, that sounds great! I'm just quivering with excitement.
That's great to hear. Atrial fibrillation is a common condition you'll encounter in your patients. Before we start talking about the abnormal, let's do a review of normal physiology. The cardiac conduction system is an organized spread of electrical activity throughout the heart that leads to cardiac muscle contraction. This results in coordinated pumping of blood from the atria to the ventricles out to the lungs and systemic circulation.
The default pacemaker of the heart is the sinoatrial, or SA node, located at the junction of the right atrium and superior vena cava. Signals from the SA node spread through the atria, causing atrial cells to contract. The signal then reaches the atrioventricular, or AV node, located on the intra-atrial septum near the coronary sinus. The AV node slows the electrical signal for a moment, so the atria finishes contracting to allow maximal filling of the ventricles before sending the signal on its way off to the bundle of His. If this didn't happen, the ventricles and atria would contract at the same time. Not a very efficient way to pump blood through the body.
The bundle of His splits off into two branches, the left bundle branch and the right bundle branch, which run down the interventricular septum and then go their separate ways, conducting the signal to the left and right ventricles. Finally, the signal reaches the Purkinje fibers, which deliver the electrical signal to the ventricles, leading to ventricular contraction. All right, now that we've got the cardiac conduction system down, let's move on to tachyarrhythmias.
Uh-oh, I can feel myself going into arrhythmia right now, just thinking about this.
Don't worry. While tachyarrhythmias can be a confusing topic, they can be classified with just two easy questions. We'll do an overview, but we'll stay focused on what's relevant for atrial fibrillation. So, you've got an ECG in your hands and it shows tachycardia. What are you looking at to determine what kind of tachycardia it is?
First, is the QRS complex wide or narrow? A narrow QRS is less than or equal to 120 milliseconds, aka three small boxes on an ECG. This means that the rhythm is supraventricular in origin, originating at or above the AV node. The signal travels through the AV node to the bundle of His and Purkinje fibers, which is the normal path of electrical conduction, resulting in simultaneous ventricular contraction.
In contrast, a wide complex QRS is over 120 milliseconds. This means that the rhythm is ventricular in origin, i.e. coming from the ventricles. Alternatively, it could be due to aberrant conduction, meaning that the rhythm is from a supraventricular origin, but isn't following the normal His-Purkinje conducting pathway. This indicates that the ventricles are contracting out of sync, which is why you see a wide QRS complex.
Now, the second question is the rhythm regular or irregular? All you have to do here is look at the RR interval, the distance between the R waves of two consecutive QRS complexes, and determine if it's consistent throughout the ECG tracing. If it is consistent, it's a regular rhythm. If it changes, it's an irregular rhythm.
Let's give some examples. Feel free to look these up to see what these rhythms look like on an ECG. An example of a wide complex regular tachycardia is ventricular tachycardia. An example of a wide complex irregular tachycardia is polymorphic ventricular tachycardia. An example of a narrow complex regular tachycardia is sinus tachycardia. Finally, an example of a narrow complex irregular tachycardia is atrial fibrillation.
Cue title card! Atrial fibrillation is characterized by abnormal electrical activity in the atria of the heart. Instead of a coordinated flow of electrical activity from the SA node to the AV node, the disorganized electrical currents cause the atria to fibrillate instead. Keep in mind that regardless of the etiology, AFib is driven by the ectopic foci originating in the atria. You can see this on an ECG by the distinct lack of P waves, which normally represent atrial depolarization. However, some atrial conduction can still propagate through the AV node and through normal electrical pathways to the ventricles, resulting in a normal narrow QRS complex. AFib is generally grouped into new onset, chronic, or paroxysmal AFib, in which patients can variably go in and out of sinus rhythm.
There are many risk factors for atrial fibrillation. A common acronym used to remember this is PIRATES. P for pulmonary embolism or other pulmonary disease, I for idiopathic or ischemic heart disease, R for rheumatic valvular disease, A for age and anemia, T for thyroid disease, E for elevated blood pressure or enlarged atrium, and S for sepsis, sleep apnea, and surgery, i.e. post-op AFib. The most common causes you'll encounter are usually in the context of congestive heart failure, advanced age, lung disease, and around the time of surgery. There are also states that can precipitate atrial fibrillation, such as hypoxia, hypovolemia, and electrolyte abnormalities. Typically, AFib is associated with some kind of underlying heart disease, as well as changes in the electrical conduction pathways of the atria. It is also associated with an increased risk of perioperative cardiac complications, such as an increased risk of heart failure and stroke. Keep in mind the CHA-65 score, which predicts the risk of stroke in patients with AFib, as well as the HAS-BLED score, which predicts the risk of bleeding in patients who are anticoagulated for AFib. We'll get back to this in a sec.
All right, now that we have the basics down, let's discuss perioperative considerations for atrial fibrillation. Ectopic atrial foci can cause a very rapid heart rate up to 180 beats per minute, known as rapid ventricular response. This can have significant adverse effects on normal cardiac function. During late atrial systole, a phenomenon known as atrial kick provides up to 20% of left ventricular filling. During AFib, with rapid ventricular response, the profound tachycardia can lead to inadequate time for this atrial kick to occur, resulting in poor ventricular filling and reduced cardiac output. This is particularly important in elderly patients who have stiffer ventricles and are more dependent on this atrial kick to maintain adequate stroke volume. If this is suddenly lost, patients can experience hypotension, pulmonary edema, and heart failure.
So remember that generally in AFib, the faster the heart rate, the less filling time the ventricles have, and the less forward blood flow. This can exacerbate hypotension. In addition, note that the left ventricle is perfused only during diastole. The faster the heart rate, the less time available for myocardial perfusion. Decreased oxygen delivery, combined with an increased oxygen demand from the tachycardia, can cause myocardial ischemia, which is especially dangerous for patients with pre-existing coronary artery disease.
All this means that it's important to maintain either rate control or rhythm control for a patient with AFib. Rhythm control refers to restoring the heart rhythm back to the normal sinus rhythm. Rate control refers to slowing down the ventricular rate, typically to less than 85 beats per minute in symptomatic patients or less than 110 in asymptomatic patients. These patients remain in atrial fibrillation without conversion back to normal sinus.
Before we talk about rate and rhythm management in atrial fibrillation, we need to talk about anticoagulation.
First, let's consider new onset AFib. One key piece of history to establish is the time since the onset of the arrhythmia. If it's been less than 48 hours since onset, the patient is at low risk of developing an atrial thrombus. This means they are at low risk of stroke after reversion to sinus rhythm. However, if it has been over 48 hours and you don't know when their AFib started, the stagnant blood in the fibrillating atria could have formed a thrombus, which could embolize into the systemic circulation when sinus rhythm is reestablished. In these cases, patients will need an echocardiogram to exclude a thrombus or a course of anticoagulation before cardioversion is attempted.
Okay, now let's say instead we have a patient with pre-existing atrial fibrillation. These patients are at higher risk of stroke. Anticoagulation can reduce this risk. However, the benefit of this must be balanced against the risk of major bleeding, which is unsurprisingly a significant adverse effect of anticoagulants.
The CHA-65 score is a risk stratification tool used to determine the one-year risk of a thromboembolic event for a non-anticoagulated patient with a non-valvular AFib. Non-valvular meaning that the AFib was not caused by a problem with a heart valve, usually mitral stenosis.
The CHA-65 risk factors are congestive heart failure, hypertension, age greater than or equal to 75, diabetes, and a history of stroke or TIA symptoms, which is 2 points.
Anticoagulation is not recommended with a CHA-65 score of 0. Anticoagulation can be considered depending on a patient's preferences and individual risk factors if they have a score of 1 to 2. Anticoagulation should be started in patients who have a score of greater to or equal to 3. Medications used for this are typically direct oral anticoagulants such as apixaban or rivaroxaban. It's increasingly rare to see patients with AFib on warfarin. This is usually reserved for patients with valvular AFib, which is AFib due to underlying valvular pathology.
Okay, so that's how you estimate the risk of thromboembolism. Guess what? There's another handy tool for assessing the risk of major bleeding, the HAS-BLED score. The risk factors are uncontrolled hypertension, which is over 160 systolic, abnormal renal or liver function, a history of stroke, prior major bleeding, a labile INR, elderly, i.e. over 65 years old, and use of drugs predisposing to bleeding or alcohol use.
Now, if you do encounter a patient on anticoagulations already, it's very important that this is properly managed prior to surgery, because as you can imagine, it poses a problem when it comes to surgical bleeding and the options you have for providing neuroaxial or regional anesthesia. Patients on DOAC, such as apixaban or rivaroxaban, can discontinue their medications for 1 day before surgery for minor procedures or 2 days before surgery for major procedures. Patients on warfarin require discontinuation for 5 days before surgery due to its longer half-life.
For patients at high risk of thromboembolism, consider bridging therapy. This refers to giving a short-acting anticoagulant, usually unfractionated or low molecular weight heparin, in the perioperative period to minimize the time in which patients are not anticoagulated. This is a good time to call an expert for advice, so consider consulting hematology.
All right, now let's talk about the rate and rhythm management of atrial fibrillation. The first question you want to ask is the patient stable or unstable?
Signs of hemodynamic instability include hypotension, chest pain, signs of frank congestive heart failure, and altered level of consciousness. This automatically buys the patient electrical cardioversion, a shock to the heart, with the goal of reverting the heart rhythm back to normal sinus.
If the patient is stable, we can try to rate control with using medications. Some examples include beta blockers such as metoprolol and esmolol, or calcium channel blockers such as verapamil. Next is the decision of whether to try rhythm control to revert the patient back to sinus rhythm. This is preferred in patients who are recently diagnosed with AFib, at least within the last year, and are highly symptomatic or have difficulty achieving rate control.
Rhythm control can be achieved with either pharmacologic or electrical cardioversion. Pharmacologic means utilize antiarrhythmics like amiodarone. Electrical cardioversion, as we've already seen, uses a shock to reset the heart and return it to normal sinus rhythm. Electrical cardioversion tends to be preferred for rhythm control due to, oddly enough, pro-arrhythmic properties of antiarrhythmic drugs.
Wow, try to save that 5 times fast. In summary, remember the acronym PIRATES for the etiologies of AFib, and keep in mind the physiology of atrial kick, reduced ventricular filling, altered cardiac output, and reduced myocardial perfusion for patients with rapid AFib, especially during the intraoperative period.
The keys of intraoperative management include aggressive rate control and expert consultation from cardiology and electrophysiology if required. Consider the CHA-65 score to determine the anticoagulation requirements and the HAS-BLED score for the risk of bleeding. And always think about how patients who are anticoagulated may not necessarily be candidates for regional or neuroaxial anesthesia because of the risk of bleeding.
Awesome! Now let's apply some of these concepts in a clinical case.
Your patient is a 70-year-old lady presenting for a hysterectomy and bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy. Her past medical history is significant for hypertension, hypothyroidism, and sleep apnea. She also has a history of TIAs. Her past surgical history includes an appendectomy at age 24. Medications include amlodipine, ramipril, atorvastatin, aspirin, and levothyroxine. She has no allergies. Social history is significant for 4 to 5 glasses of wine per week.
On physical exam, the patient is a Mallampati 2 with thyromental distance, mandibular protrusion, and neck extension within normal limits. Her heart rate is normal sinus rhythm with a regular S1 and S2 with no murmurs and no extra heart sounds. Her respiratory exam is also normal with no adventitious sounds.
She receives a general anesthetic with an endotracheal tube. An hour into the surgery, we notice that the heart rate has jumped from 88 to 155 and the rhythm is irregularly irregular. We check a blood pressure and find it is 110 over 78. Her oxygen saturation is 98%. What should we do?
This patient has new onset atrial fibrillation with rapid ventricular response. First, it's important to identify and correct any precipitating factors, such as hypoxia, hypovolemia, or electrolyte abnormalities. These are unlikely given the patient was well preoperatively and has been stable intraoperatively until now.
Since our patient's blood pressure is stable, we'll first try to rate control with a beta blocker or calcium channel blocker. One option is esmolol. You start with 0.5 milligrams per kilogram and assess its effect.
Unfortunately, the patient's heart rate remains in the 150s. The blood pressure cuff cycles again, and the pressure has fallen to 75 over 42. What should we do now?
At this point, the patient has become hemodynamically unstable, which is an indication for urgent electrical cardioversion. You ask the surgeon to stop operating, remove their cautery and surgical instruments, call for a crash cart, and place pads on the patient. You deliver a shock, and the patient reverts back to normal sinus rhythm with a heart rate of 86 and a blood pressure of 119 over 75.
Yay! We did it!
Wait, we're not done yet!
Aw.
The patient has new onset atrial fibrillation, which may require maintenance medication to ensure they remain in normal sinus rhythm. She will also require additional monitoring postoperatively with telemetry.
Oh, what is our patient's CHADS 65 score? She gets 1 for hypertension and 2 for a history of TIAs for a total of 3. So anticoagulation is recommended, at least for a few weeks, because atrial fibrillation can recur. She will also benefit from urgent postoperative consultation by cardiology.
Great work, everyone. Let's summarize what we've learned today.
Atrial fibrillation is a common arrhythmia resulting from aberrant electrical activity in the atria of the heart. It is recognized on ECG by an irregular rhythm with no distinct P waves. There are 3 main considerations in the management of atrial fibrillation.
1. Treating precipitating factors. It's important to address modifiable risk factors by optimizing patients prior to surgery and to treat reversible causes of atrial fibrillation.
2. Assessing thromboembolic risk. Patients with new onset AFib within the last 48 hours do not require anticoagulation before attempting to revert to sinus rhythm. Patients with persistent AFib who meet the criteria for anticoagulation, as per their CHADS 65 score, need appropriate medication management in the perioperative period to reduce the risk of bleeding during surgery while minimizing their risk of stroke.
3. Restoring sinus rhythm or rate control. If possible, patients in atrial fibrillation should be converted back to normal sinus rhythm by pharmacologic or electrical cardioversion. If this isn't possible, their heart rate should be controlled to a ventricular rate of around 80 to 110 beats per minute.
And that concludes this podcast episode. We hope that you'll be able to apply what you learned today to your clinical rotations.
We would like to thank our content editors, Dr. Peru Panchel and Dr. Mohammed Sharaf Aldeen. And a big thanks to Dr. Cordovani and Dr. Whippy for their support. Also, make sure to check out our website, tweet us at our Twitter page at Airwave Podcast, and follow us on Instagram at Airwave Podcast for any questions or suggestions.
And until next time, keep working hard, stay healthy, stay safe, take some nice deep breaths, and count back from 10.